if you're going to write a lot, then you need to start not by thinking about writing, but by thinking about reading, because reading is what fuels your writing. The church in the United States has faced a lot of crises in the last 20 years or so. There's been the sex abuse scandals. There's been widespread moral failures among many leaders. There's been a credibility crisis when it comes to some authoritarian tendencies. All different kinds of churches, all different kinds of organizations with different kinds of accountability built in. We've seen rot and failure in all of them. There's not one place.
Welcome to the Lausanne Movement podcast, where we have a passion to accelerate global mission together. I am your host, Jason Watson, and today on the podcast, we sit down with the renowned author, Dr. Trevin Wax, who is also a scholar and leader within the North American Mission Board. In our conversation, Trevin unpacks the evolving landscape of the U.S. church, and we discuss the challenges the American church is facing and the vital role that global missionaries are playing within the U.S. context right now, and the unique contributions that the North American church brings to the global body of Christ. Beyond his work in missions, Trevin is also a prolific author, writing for the Gospel Coalition along with many of his own personal books. Trevin unpacks his process in writing and offers actionable advice for those of you who are aspiring authors. So, I invite you to sit down and enjoy today's episode with Dr. Trevin Wax. Trevin, welcome to the podcast. It's really great to have you with us today.
It's great to be with you, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
That's great. I mean, Trevin, you've had a fascinating journey from missionary work in Romania to your current role with the North American Mission Board, not to mention your academic contributions and the writing that you've been doing. But today I'm interested in unpacking some of your thoughts and your observations around the state of Christianity in the US, as well as digging into some of your insights that you might have gained in your writing. For those who are aspiring writers, I hope that they might hear something from you and begin that work that God has called them to write. But before we get there, I'd like to hear more about your time in Romania. It's not every day I get to sit with a missionary who's been out in Romania. So could you take a moment just to reflect back on your time as a missionary there? What was it like? And how has that experience shaped your perspective on global mission and the impact of your work today with the North American Mission Board?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, I first developed a real heart for missions as a young person growing up in a youth group that was pretty engaged and involved with international missions generally in short-term trips. And then was also supporting missionaries in a lot of parts of the world. And my first trip there was when I was 15. And it was just a few years after communism had fallen there. And so they were beginning to come out of that era in which there had been a lot of oppression, both religious, political oppression, had been under the rule of a dictator. And so it was the beginning of a semi-Westernization process that was taking place. I was there short-term trips for several years and then moved there when I was 19, lived there for 5 years. I was both a student at an evangelical university and did a lot of work in villages around the city that I lived in. For me, that experience was very formative because it was full on complete immersion into different churches, into different culture, I had to learn the language to become fluent in that. It's where I learned how to preach. It's where I learned to teach, did kids ministry, youth ministry, all kinds of things in the established evangelical presence that was already there. So it wasn't frontline mission work in terms of planting new churches and whatnot. It was more support. But I think the impact for that for me though was the longer that you're outside of the cultural milieu that you were raised in, the more you come back with fresh eyes and are able to see things that you've always just taken for granted. This is one of the benefits of connection with people in other parts of the world and the global church, is because you wind up being able to see with fresh eyes some things that are cultural, and then you can distinguish those cultural things from what we would consider the core of Christianity and those elements that are unchanging, that are part of the good deposit, the faith that's been delivered to us that we want to pass on unaltered. So I think for me, the big impact of those years of experience were to give me some cross-cultural experience that has really served me well in the different places that I've been able to serve and hopefully edify the church and bring new people into the kingdom.
Well, no, thank you for sharing that. You know, we shared a bit of air about how missionaries are a special kind of people. They have the singular focus. They've got a call of God in their life. They've got a fire in their belly. And for me in South Africa, I've encountered many, many missionaries from all over the world come through. And usually they're quite consistent. They're here for years and years and years. And so it's always interesting to hear about a missionary who's felt a call to go across, you know, to different continents to preach the gospel, to be involved in mission, to going back to their home context. So could you share a bit about your journey from being a missionary on the mission field to becoming a writer and now the vice president of research and resource development at the North American Mission Board? How did that process happen?
For me, the writing started even before the mission work, in that I just have been writing ever since I was a kid. That's been just an aspect of how I am wired, I think. Like, I recognized that early on. I had people around me who were giving me encouragement to develop that skill and craft and gift. And so during the time I was in Romania, I was also beginning to write some primarily devotional material, but things for people back in the United States and in other parts of the world. And then when I was both a seminary student and then when I back in the United States, and then when I was serving in different church contexts here, I just continued to develop that, to write. I started, you know, a blog back in 2006 that where I would just consistently...
Early adopter.
That's right. That helped me just develop the consistency in that. And then I worked at Lifeway Christian Resources for 11 years as an editor. So I was doing both editing and writing at the time. So at that point, was already publishing some books, but also editing a curriculum called the Gospel Project, which it's a small group curriculum for all ages that is focused on showing how all of the Bible points to Jesus, how it's one grand narrative. And so the opportunity to work with a bunch of writers as well, to help sharpen them, to help make those contributions better, that was really formative for me as well. So getting all of that experience over the years has been one of the primary ways that I see myself as a servant of the church. I look at myself as a writer first, and everything else is sort of beyond that. I do love preaching. I'm doing an interim pastorate role right now. I love preaching. I love teaching. I love being in the academic world. I love being able to be in conversation with missionaries and church planters and all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, I think the greatest place where I have gift and calling is in writing. And so I want to continue to cultivate that.
Yeah. And I'm really excited to unpack some of your thoughts behind that, the processes that you take in terms of writing for those who are aspiring writers. But before we go there, I would love to unpack some of your thoughts and your reflections on the state of Christianity in North America. You have a great opportunity as the Vice President of Research and Resource Development to kind of get a good feel. You've traveled around the states quite a bit. You've engaged with multiple denominations, as we've spoken about off air. How would you describe the state of the evangelical church in North America? What key trends are you noticing that you think our listeners should be paying attention to? You know, I think many of our listeners, a large majority of our listeners, about 40% of the audio listeners to this podcast are from the United States. The rest are a global audience. And what I've enjoyed about interacting with global guests is to hear a bit about their context. And so I would love to unpack the context of the US, to hear about that and to bring that to light for our global audience. And then also maybe to broaden the perspective of those who are listening from the US as well. So with that preamble, what key trends are you noticing that you think our listeners should be paying attention to?
Well, there are several things going on with the church. And I mean, we could point to both challenges and opportunities when it comes to Christianity in North America and with the advance of the gospel here. I'd say one of the big things to mention is there has been a secularization process that has taken different forms in North America than particularly in the United Kingdom or in Australia and in other places, where there still is a lot of cultural Christianity in a lot of places in North America. So there's sort of this residue of Christianity. Because there's no state church here, there's been more of a market mentality when it comes to churches. So like churches are seen as sort of in competition with each other for congregants. And so it's almost as if the church, whether people actually intentionally want this to be the case or not, people tend to see the church as a dispenser of religious goods and services. And it's more difficult to have a very tight community, a covenantal understanding of church membership, things like that in the United States because of that sort of consumer mentality. So like the sociologist Peter Berger has said, in a market economy, the church basically is in that sort of market mentality, whether they want to be or not, or whether we even think that's biblical. It's just recognizing that's one of the aspects that we have to deal with. The church in the United States has faced a lot of crises in the last 20 years or so. There's been the sex abuse scandals. There's been widespread moral failures among many leaders. There's been a credibility crisis when it comes to some authoritarian tendencies in certain non-denominational big churches and even some churches associated with denominations. So there's been something of a reckoning that has happened there. At the same time, for the last 25 years or so, there's been a pretty remarkable decline in church going as well. There have been just people that have been leaving the church, not for the reasons that often get the headlines. The reasons that people give that you see online is, well, everyone's deconstructing their faith, or all these people who are leaving church or no longer attending church or no longer attending because they're upset about the church's injustices or abuse scandals and things like that. Actually, the main reasons that people stop going to church are much more down to earth and actually more routine. You know, they move to a different place and just never find a church to plug in, or they go through a family crisis, maybe a divorce or something, and then they don't get back into church, or they dropped out during college and they just haven't returned yet or whatnot. So a lot of those more pedestrian reasons are there, but that is an aspect of the climate in North America that we have to take into consideration. I think it's important, if we're thinking about North America, though, to realize that the overarching conditions are not favorable to religious practice and belief. They are unfavorable. From the Enlightenment assumptions that assume that God, if he's there, is irrelevant, or that religion is a personal and private thing, it's not something that's actually, it's not something that's going to have a lot of impact outside of just whatever personal spirituality you adopt. From the Enlightenment philosophy to the sort of what's called expressive individualism, this idea of being true to yourself as the purpose of life, finding the real you inside and then expressing that to the world. And then you add the consumer side of things, this consumeristic understanding where, you know, church is there to meet the spiritual needs that you have, that you contribute if you're getting your needs met. You kind of put all that together, and it's not, the soil is not conducive to deep spiritual growth and flourishing. It's not a soil that is conducive to deep roots. It's not a soil that's conducive to close community. These are not conditions favorable necessarily to God being the center of a person's life. If he is there, he's more at the periphery. And so recognizing that those sort of cultural conditions, I think, is really important in North America, that these are some of the challenges that we face. They're not completely unprecedented. The percentage of Americans who attend church regularly is about what it was in the early 1940s. And in fact, it is higher today than it was even during the founding of the United States in the 1700s, after the first period of the Great Awakening and whatnot. So there's been ebb and flow throughout church history, Christian history in North America, as to where the state of North America would be. I'm focusing primarily on the United States. The situation is different in Canada. It's obviously different in other parts of North America. But I think that what happens in the United States, like it or not, does have an outsized impact in some of the other areas of North America as well.
So I'd be interested to hear from you as we look ahead and we hear about these trends, we think about the conditions that the North American church are growing in the U.S. In the future, how should church leaders and Christians prepare to meet these challenges and to face these trends? Like, as you face toward the future of the U.S., how do you anticipate the church, like, what direction is the church going in? And what should church leaders and Christians who love the church, love the U.S. church, what should they be doing?
Well, I think that's going to look different depending on the denomination and depending on the particular context where we're trying to see church health improve. But one of the things I'm constantly telling church leaders, I've done a kind of a documentary style podcast called Reconstructing Faith, not deconstructing, but reconstructing faith. And the focus on that has really been, there's a lot of the church's witness that has really been left in a shambles in the last 20 to 30 years. And the task of the next generation, my generation, I think for the next 30 to 40 years, is going to be rebuilding the church's witness, rebuilding our core communities to where we don't just have the facade, the outward facade of faithfulness, where we're hollowed out on the inside, but we actually are a really vibrant community in a world that has lost the ability to form and to sustain close bonds of connection and friendship. So what I'm encouraging pastors and church leaders to do in this current cultural moment is to say, we need to recognize that, yes, there has been a lot of rot in the church in North America that has been revealed. It's been exposed. It's been an apocalyptic type of environment. This has been an event that has exposed a lot of rot. But what we need to do then is to roll up our sleeves and to remove the rot and to fortify the foundations. And like the people in Nehemiah's day, to find a place on the wall where we can build. Not everyone can do everything, but everyone can do something. And so what I'm encouraging pastors and church leaders, depending on their context, their denominational affiliation, wherever they might be, I'm encouraging pastors and church leaders to think constructively and to ask the question, we're living in a time where institutional health is at a low, not just for the church, but institutions in general. People have a very, in North America in particular, they have a very low opinion of institutions, from everything from the military to the government to social ministries to the church. The bad news is institutional distrust is at an all-time high. The good news is the church isn't an outlier in this. All of the institutions have taken a hit. So it's kind of like the way sometimes investors will tell you when the stock market plummets in a particular field that you expect it will go back up at some point. It's when the stock market plummets that is the time to then buy up some investments, you know, buy up those stocks. I want pastors and church leaders to recognize that in a time of widespread institutional distrust, in particular with the church, this is the time to invest in the church. Because as institutions do pull back, they do come back, and they will, because as human beings, we need them to. As institutions do begin to build back, the question is, how healthy will they be? What kind of institutions will they be? The church will be here in 40 years in North America. The question is, what kind of church will it be? How strong will it be? How effective will its witness be? So what I'm encouraging pastors and church leaders to do is to figure out where on the wall they can make the greatest difference, where they can make the contribution, and to roll up our sleeves and to be busy in the rebuilding project.
So Trevin, you mentioned the rot that has been revealed in not only the US church. I mean, it's a global movement of just church leader after church leader, mission leader, just terrible things being revealed. Where do you think that rot comes from? What is the cause? And what do you say to someone? Because this has been something that I've had to address as people come to me who have been deeply wounded by spiritual leadership in their, like, the revelation of their downfall. How do you respond to people who are now questioning? You mentioned the whole idea of deconstruction, deconstructing their faith because of the rot. So sum up, in your opinion, where does the rot come from, and how do we respond faithfully to those revelations?
Well, I mean, the simple answer as to where the rot comes from is sin and human corruption, which is endemic to the human condition. And I think we recognize that at the end of the day, that's the simple theological answer, is sin. But we can look beyond the theological answer to some sociological and cultural realities, asking questions about some of our institutions. Have we perhaps aided and abetted the kinds of systems and structures where sin can flourish? I don't think that there's any one particular place that we can point to and say, aha, it's that church or that denomination's polity that's at fault. If anything, the Lord has stripped away, through these revelations, the Lord has stripped away any sense of superiority we might have because we think our church could, you know, is somehow immune to some of these challenges. All different kinds of churches with all different kinds of government and setups, all different kinds of organizations with different kinds of accountability built in, we've seen rot and failure in all of them. There's not one place. Now, there may be some that are more prone to some of these abuses than others. There may be some areas where accountability is not there for leaders and where it becomes more prevalent. But, and so I do think we can look at those things, but I don't think we can say, the solution is just change the system or change the structure and that this won't happen again. I think we've got to look, first of all, and recognize that sin is pervasive. It's parasitical. And it's actually, if you look at sin as a parasite, you realize it needs to attach itself to a living host. One of the reasons why the sin has been so devastating in its revelation is because it has attached itself to organizations where there is a lot of spiritual vibrancy in life. You know, it's often said the evil one doesn't go after the ones who are not a threat to him. The evil one goes after the churches and the movements and the organizations and the leaders that pose the biggest threat to the kingdom of darkness. And so I think we've got to recognize sin. We've got to recognize the reality of evil in this world, the reality of a spiritual warfare that is taking place. And we have to recognize in some of these cases that there have been systems and structures where accountability has not been in place, where people have shunned the kind of accountability that is actually necessary for good and healthy and transparent leadership. So that's my quick answer to that question. But to the answer to the person who's been disillusioned and hurt, You know, that's a pastoral question. And I think we can offer explanations and we can offer theological rationale that is all true, but doesn't meet the person in pain who's actually asking the question, is any of this real for anyone? And I think that's where we have to start with the person across the table from us, is recognizing that hurt, that disillusionment, it cuts deep. When a shepherd abuses their authority, it's one of the things that God is most angry about in the Old Testament. If you look back at the bad shepherds mentioned in Jeremiah and Ezekiel and whatnot, when God loves the sheep, and when shepherds are the ones who go astray or who abuse the sheep in the name of the Lord, that is a particular, there's a spiritual element to that that is particularly damaging to people. And so we shouldn't be surprised that people begin to ask questions and they wonder if any of it's real or if any of it's true or why should they belong to a church and whatnot. And so we as the church have got to re-envision ourselves as places of healing and restoration and growth for people who have been wounded, who have been disillusioned and have been demoralized. I don't think lecturing people who are having a crisis of faith resolves a person's crisis of faith. I think walking with a person through a crisis of faith, it's what's necessary in that moment. And we as the church shouldn't be surprised by doubt, shouldn't be surprised by disillusionment. We, of all people, should be the ones who are most caring and loving and willing the good of the other in a moment like this.
Thanks, Trevor. I really appreciate that empathetic approach and that pastoral approach to that question. And I think you're right, you know, that it's through those relational connections of journeying with people that they experience and re-experience the love of Christ. I'd like to pivot just a bit and dive back into the state of Christianity in the US. So Luzon has commissioned the Luzon State of the Great Commission report. And one of the findings that was fascinating to me was the stats related to missionaries being sent and received. And the US, it may not be a surprise to you, the US is the number one country for sending out the most missionaries than any other country in the rest of the world. But what's fascinating is the US is also receiving the most missionaries than any other country in the world. How do you interpret this? What value do you believe that global missionaries could add to US Christianity?
Well, there's so many fascinating aspects of that question and that development. And I mean, one of them is the really good development that we no longer see missions as an outward movement from the West to other parts of the world, but we actually recognize, you know, what's called polycentric mission, in that its missions are taking place from everyone to everywhere, almost like we're in seeking to reach the unreached, but then also in seeking to reach pockets of people in different countries as well. You've got so many different places with so much expertise and cultural knowledge where this is why we're all able to benefit from one another. So the idea that the United States or England basically exports missionaries to other parts of the world has now reversed, and we're seeing the need, especially when you look at the decline of Christianity in the West in terms of the overarching percentages of Christians in the world, it makes sense that people would actually focus on even North America for that. One of the other things, though, that really makes me excited about that development is we've got to no longer look at North America and immediately just assume North America is the middle-aged white man or woman and their family or whatnot. If you really look at what's happening demographically in North America, in particular in the United States, what you see is so much growth in diversity to the point that it's possible that within a decade or two, the United States will be a majority-minority or a minority-majority country, meaning that there won't, even though the category we give white will be still the greatest, it will be under 50% as those who identify as white. Now, there are some differences of opinion as to whether or not that will be the case, because in some cases with assimilation or whatnot, you do have people from other parts of the world that come from various ethnicities that over time will eventually begin to identify as white. So it's possible that that isn't exactly what happens. But regardless, the reality is that the United States has historically been a melting pot for all sorts of different cultures, and at the same time has been a place for different enclaves and pockets of different people groups to come. So one of the things we like to talk about at the North American Mission Board is we need the expertise of missionaries who have done cross-cultural missions in other parts of the world, because we need to be doing cross-cultural missions at home. Many of the church plants that are supported through the North American Mission Board, for example, are church plants that are minority ethnic, whether, you know, there's first or second generation Korean immigrants in California, or whether or not they're, you know, Ethiopian immigrants, or whether you've just got across the spectrum, you have so many different kinds of churches. And so what's exciting to me is when I think about other parts of the world sending missionaries here, is in some of those cases, they're coming from countries where, in many of those cases, they're coming from countries to minister to the people group that is here in the United States that needs gospel presence and gospel witness in ways that can be more effective at times than, you know, simply the white American or the Hispanic American or whatnot that's down the street. And so there's so much opportunity for partnership and for seeing the need from people from other parts of the world coming to the United States to help because of this exploding diversity that we have in the United States at this time in order to reach the people that God has brought to our doorstep.
Thank you, Trevor. And I really appreciate the nuance. I mean, it's a very complicated question to answer, but I appreciate the fact that you've recognized the value that the global church could add to the North American context, especially considering how diverse the states has become and is becoming. I would love to explore the flip side to that question as well, and to ask, there is a conversation among the global church about the Americanization of Christianity globally. As people have unpacked that and broken that down and tried to find their own voice within their own culture, what contribution, you spoke about the contribution that various, you know, ethnicities could make in the North American context, but what contribution do you believe the North American church has to offer the global church today?
I love that question because mutuality and partnership is really, in collaboration, is really what we see in the New Testament. And it's what we've seen in the most effective missions movements over the centuries. And that it is how we should be thinking. We should be asking constantly the question of how can the church in different parts of the world, how can we help each other? I think one of the areas where North America has some distinct contributions, obviously there is a long history of Christianity here that has obviously its flaws and failures as well that we can sometimes see in 3D looking back. But we also have to recognize the fruitfulness that has come about from this. And one of the things that we find in the United States, for example, is a lot of passionate entrepreneurial thinking that just coincides with something in the American dream, the American psyche. There are aspects of that that can be idolatrous, but there are also aspects of that that can be redirected toward a holy ambition. And I think seeing that in the United States, that entrepreneurial spirit, the amount of resources here that can be used to bless other parts of the world, the theological contributions are also considerable when you think about the history of Christianity in the West. There has to be some disentangling from some cultural assumptions that over time we begin to see, you know, some of that was more cultural than Christian. And I think the same is true. That's actually true for the church in every era of history in all parts of the world. One of the things I like to say about the church globally is that the United States and North America needs the global church because we're a mess in a lot of ways, and we need the global church's perspective. But the truth is, and many people that are listening that are in other parts of the world will readily admit this, I think, the church is probably a mess where they are as well. And they need some of the contributions of North America. The beautiful thing about the church is we're not all a mess in the exact same way. We're all messy. We all have our problems and flaws and failures. But thanks be to God, they're not all the same flaws and failures. We're not all a mess in the same way. So the strengths of other parts of the world can help the United States. And then some of the strengths that the United States and North America would have can also help in other parts of the world. And I think it's important for us to recognize that there's no sort of flawless church out there that is doing everything exactly according to scripture. We're all seeking to sharpen one another. And I think some of what is terrific in the United States context is that entrepreneurial spirit, the resources that we do have financially and theologically at our disposal that can be used for the blessing and the benefit of churches in other parts of the world, and hopefully will lead to greater kingdom effectiveness. Not an Americanization, but a stronger kingdom partnership.
Oh, thanks, Trevin. Thank you for unpacking a bit of your own context, your own thoughts about North America, US, and the global church. I feel like we could keep going there, but I do want to go to your heart passion, which is writing, and just hear a bit about that from yourself. So let's start by discussing what motivates you to write. Why do you believe your work in writing and developing resources is crucial for the church and society today? And what drives you to continuously work on this part of your ministry?
Well, it's hard for me to answer the question of where the drive comes from, because I never remember a time of life where I didn't have it. So it's almost like asking me, like, why do you breathe? You know, like, well, it's because I just have to. That's just the way that I think. And writing actually is connected to thinking for me. I think the passion for it, though, in doing it consistently, comes from the reality that I want to serve the church. And I know that good writing, thoughtful writing, reflection, theological writing, cultural writing has shaped me and has benefited my life so much. Knowing that I can do that, and if I might be able to help someone else, that's what really revs me up and wants me to write in public. One of the best things that someone can tell me, one of my favorite emails or responses I will get from someone when I've written something that has struck a chord with someone, is they will say, "You put into words what I've been thinking, but I didn't know how to say it." And I love when someone tells me that, because that tells me that's the gift that I have and want to bring to the church, is I want to be able to articulate in words some of the instincts, some of the feelings, some of the thoughts that other people may have that are not quite as well formulated, not as easy to express. And if I can bring that and can shape other people through writing in that way, that's one way I think I can bless the church in my own context and worldwide. And so that's what keeps me going when it can be tough. I don't enjoy the writing process as much as I enjoy finishing up the writing and feeling like, oh, there's something, I'm saying something here that is substantive enough that hopefully this will benefit and bless the church.
You know, as I think about writing, it's almost, you're putting your heart on paper, right? You're putting your thoughts on paper. And when you, the moment you do that, you are bound not only to get positive feedback, like you mentioned, but also to engage with critics in this whole process. How do you handle that criticism? As I think about people who may want to be writers one day, perhaps one of the things that stops them is the fear of rejection, the fear of criticism. So how do you deal with that, particularly when it pertains to your deeply held beliefs? I mean, when you're writing what you believe is true in your heart and your mind. And what advice would you give to leaders or to future writers for dealing with feedback in a constructive way?
Well, I've always wanted to be someone who's really open to criticism. And occasionally, if you write long enough in public, you're going to have people skewering you for something that you've said online. They're ready to critique and to criticize, sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly. But I've always looked at writing in public as more of a conversation rather than a pronouncement. And so if I write something that strikes a chord in a good way, I love that. If I write something that strikes a chord in a bad way, meaning a lot of people took issue with it, I want to hear them out for the most part. And so I'm always open to somebody who reads something I say, and maybe they disagree with me. Maybe they misunderstood me. Maybe I didn't articulate or clearly say or maybe I didn't say something as clearly as I thought I did, and I will need to clarify, or maybe that's just something I need to take into consideration, the pushback, if they disagree vehemently with something where they did understand me well, and I did clearly say what I wanted to say, and we're just on different sides, then I want to ask the question, okay, where is the root of that criticism? I do think it's important in the social media age when you're writing is you got to have a thick skin, and you just have to recognize some people are not interested in really reading you fairly. They're really interested in scoring points with whatever tribe they already have on social media. And you just have to be okay with that. Like, that's just part of it. They're going to mock you or make fun of you, or they're going to pick apart your work or maybe represent it in the worst possible light rather than the best possible light. They're going to assume the worst rather than the best because they've already determined that you're one of the bad guys. You're in the other tribe that they despise. With critics like that, you have to kind of recognize when that's happening. And I think you've got to, for the most part, just tune that out. It's an unfortunate side effect of just the social media era that we're in and the very tribalistic tendencies that we have. But even from them, they're not meaning to bless you. But as Calvin Miller, the writer, used to say, your critics may not intend to bless you, but God can still bless you through your critics. If when you have criticism, you receive it, you listen to it, you may not agree with it, but if you can recognize where a good faith critic is coming from, it will shape the way that you write, the way that you think, maybe the next time you touch on that topic, the way you express yourself. And so I take it as an honor when someone reads my work. And if they take the time to thoughtfully critique my work, I take that as an honor as well.
So could you give us a real life example of a time where you faced the most pushback than any other time? And how did you navigate that pushback?
Oh, you know, I don't know if I could just point to one example where I would say it was the most pushback I've ever gotten on an article. Virtually any article that goes viral, so to speak, or that winds up becoming very widely read is going to generate some significant pushback, often from different people from different sides. It's interesting. Sometimes the pushback will come from people both on your far left, and sometimes it will come from people on your far right. Sometimes it'll come from Christians who think you're selling out the faith. Other times it will come from atheists or people who have walked away from the faith who believe you're a raving fundamentalist. When that has happened to me and I've gotten significant pushback, generally speaking, I don't get into conversations online about the pushback. I just sort of incorporate it. I think through it. I hear out if people are thoughtful and they're not just attacking. I try to weed out just the attacking types and to really listen, though, to those who have a substantive disagreement or that think that something you've said is really difficult or bad for the church or somehow untrue or false in some way. I want to hear that out. One of the things that I love from John Stott in dealing with conflict and disagreement is John Stott was always one who wanted to get people with significant disagreement around the table to really listen carefully. If someone was up in arms over some direction they thought was leading the church astray or some doctrine they felt like was seeming to be lost, even if John Stott didn't agree with their perspective or the weight that they were putting on something, he wanted to hear them out. And one of the things Stott would say was, when you'd get that person around the table and you'd really listen to what is the particular truth or doctrine that they are trying to safeguard, well, then you'd find out there's common ground there because most everyone else around the table, generally, when they really hear that brother or sister out, they find out they want to safeguard that truth as well. So then if you can at least agree to that, that this is something precious, that we want to reflect the Bible well, that we want to make disciples in our generation effectively. Once you get to that particular, you know, the nub of the disagreement, well, that's when, Stott would say, you can then have creative solutions come to the forefront. Because once everybody agrees, okay, we may not all be on the same page in terms of emphasis, but we all agree that this thing that this one person or two people are really worked up about, well, we could recognize where that's coming from. Then you begin to have the place where you get to creative solutions. And so in my writing in public online, when there's significant controversy around something I've written, I'd like to bring in some of those voices to hear from other people that think that I might be off base or going down a wrong path, because a lot of times I may actually agree with some of the concerns that they have. Or the thing that they're really concerned about is something that I share. And that's where I can get to a creative, collaborative solution. And that will hopefully influence and shape and sharpen my writing in the future.
I so appreciate the kind of nuance that you brought to that. And I think it's applicable to not just writing, but leadership in general, no matter what field we are in. When we experience that form of conflict, the advice you've given is so helpful. So we've got a few more minutes left in this podcast recording. And I'd love to just unpack a little bit more about writing. So could you take a moment? We're going to imagine that we are doing a Writers 101. What advice would you give to aspiring writers? What do you wish you had known when you had started out? And how do you discern what's worth writing and what's not worth writing? What's worth writing an article for? What's worth writing a book for? How do you discern those processes?
So many questions packed into that one, Jason. There's a lot there. First, I would say, this is going to sound counterintuitive perhaps, but if you're going to write a lot, then you need to start not by thinking about writing, but by thinking about reading, because reading is what fuels your writing. It's reading and in conversations around great books and good books and lots of books that's filling the well that you're going to need to draw from when you write. So a lot of times when people tell me they're not sure what to write about, I generally will back up and say, well, how much have you been reading? You've got to read a lot before you can write a lot. So I think that's the starting point, is to begin with really cultivating the life of the mind so that when particular issues arise and you feel like you might have a contribution to make or something to say, you have a deep well to draw from. we focus a lot of times on the final writing product and not enough the well, filling that well to where you'll be able to draw something in the moment of need. So I start with reading. A second word of counsel I would give is to write consistently, even if it's not a lot, even if it's one article a month, maybe one devotional a week, whatever it might be. Don't necessarily, writing is more like a marathon. It's not a sprint most of the time. And in order to build yourself up to being able to write an entire book or write a lot, oftentimes you'll have to pick up the pace and sort of train toward that kind of marathon. So I encourage people to read a lot, to cultivate the life of the mind, then to begin to be consistent, to hold yourself to it. I'm going to write one thing a month or one thing a week. And when you do that, you begin to find things will begin to come to you to think about writing about. If you're reading a lot, you're in conversations with other church leaders, with Christians in your congregation, you're watching things online, if there's a particular subject that interests you and fascinates you and you want to dig deeper into it, you'll begin to see connections in the world, and that will lead to article ideas or to column ideas at this particular place or magazine or online forum or site, or maybe it's an email list, a Substack, whatever it might be. The more you write, the more ideas will come to you. But I always, if you get to a place where you don't know, is this worth writing a book about or is this worth writing an article about? I think that is the third piece of advice I would give is before beginning a book, you really need to work on a really good proposal. And a proposal will be very in-depth. You'll have the chapters laid out as you see them, all of them summarized, maybe 500 words each. You'll have the value proposition of the book, the title you're thinking of. What could you sum up the book in 50 words? Could you sum it up in 100 words? What about 500 words? Is it different? How is it different than other books on the topic? Why should someone read your work on this and not someone else's work? Where is the unique proposition from this book? I find that most people that have an idea that they want to write about are generally more in the, I could write two or three columns or articles about this. But to really understand if you have a book in you, you've got to go through that the ringer of the proposal stage, which is very vitally important. And that's where the writer that's thinking about a book recognizes, no, I really don't think I have a whole book here. I probably just have a few articles or something, or I've got a few blog posts or something, or I'm going to write a couple of talks and give them somewhere. That's how you can distinguish the difference between book or article. It's that proposal process.
Thanks, Trevin. Writing 101. In a few minutes. Well done. So we're going to have to wrap up. Before we do, as you look ahead, as you think about your own life, what are some key messages or themes that you feel God is calling you to focus on in your upcoming projects? What's exciting you about the future? Could you just share that with us as we begin to close off the podcast?
Well, I'm currently working on something called a counter catechism. It's basically a counter catechesis project. And by counter, we mean it gives you the basics of the Christian faith in a question and answer format that could be utilized in, you know, at a church setting, in a small group setting, and just in a discipleship with a new believer or an older believer, it doesn't matter. We have that, but each of those questions and answers is deliberately designed to counter the prevailing worldview or ethos that we find in the Western world. So it's not just presenting Christian doctrine, but it's presenting Christian doctrine in a way that is opposed to and showing the distinction and the difference between what the world says. So if you have heard it said this in the world, but listen now to Jesus and what he says to you, this is what the scriptures teach. And so it's that way of formulating and helping people in the West understand Christianity as opposed to some of the dominant common sense thinking and practice that we find in our day and age. So I'm really passionate about that. Also very, very passionate about just continuing to write and try to serve the church in this season of reconstruction, of rebuilding our witness, of building toward a healthier church, of being constructive in those areas where we still face obstacles and challenges and helping the church overcome those.
So good. That sounds really exciting. How can people get in touch with you? They've heard some of your thoughts. They're interested in connecting with you or finding some of your books or resources. Where can they find those things?
You can just go to trevinwax.com. It'll take you to my column at the Gospel Coalition. That's where I'm writing the most regularly. I have an email newsletter that you can sign up for there. Just go to the end of any article that I write and it'll have a link to sign up. And I do enjoy talking to the email subscribers and emailing back and forth with them on different topics whenever something strikes a chord and they respond. So that's an easy way to get in touch.
Wonderful. I'll be sure to put that into the show notes. So if you want to connect with Trevor, you can go and click on the links in the show notes and go and message him. Thank him for some of the thoughts that he shared. But if you want to give him some pushback, he appreciates constructive feedback. So go for it. Trevor, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for adding value to us as a podcast audience. And may the Lord bless you in your work and your writing and all the different endeavors that you're doing. Really looking forward to that counter catechism. I think that's a great project. So blessings to you.
Thank you so much, Jason.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Lausanne Movement Podcast. If you like this episode, why don't you take a moment to give us a rating and review and give us a shout out on social media? Next week, we'll be back with another episode that we hope will inspire you to accelerate global mission within your own space. Until next week, cheers.